this episode of the Fisheries Podcast, I talk with Dr. Hannah Harrison from the University of Guelph about the social sciences and how she's used that work in Norway and now in Canada. Thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter at FisheriesPod or on Facebook at facebook.com/FisheriesPodcast. That is where you can get information about each week's episode, and occasionally I'll post extra information, which is actually something I need to do better at. But I recently got in a pinch when a guest had to reschedule right before I departed for a trip to the Great Smoky Mountains, and I put a plea out on Twitter and got a handful of very generous volunteers willing to come on the show. So our guest today is the first one of those to respond, Dr. Hannah Harrison. Hannah is a postdoctoral researcher and Arrol Food Institute Research Fellow at the University of Guelph in Ontario, Canada. She holds a PhD in Ecology and Natural Resource Management from the Norwegian University of Life Sciences, is a former U.S. Peace Corps volunteer, and a great lover of all things fish. Hannah specializes in qualitative social science and fish-slash-food-focused human dimensions research. She has worked with fish and fishers around the world from Zambia to Alaska, and currently focuses on fisheries conflict within a conservation context. Her latest project is called Coastal Roots at the University of Guelph. Thank you for volunteering to be on the show, and welcome to the podcast, Hannah.
Thanks, Nick. It's a pleasure.
There are so many interesting directions we could go with this podcast and the questions, but I think I know where I want to start based off the info you sent in your bio. You made a point to include your preferred pronunciation for the word roots. I guess, what do you have against routes?
That's kind of a funny discussion that we've been having now, which one to use. And I think it's actually just more of kind of the colloquialism that people have commonly used when they read the title of the project and then they've been asking us about it. But I think that means we're also going to have to go get the domain name of Coastal Roots, ROOTS, just to make sure that no matter how people are spelling it, they end up at the right place. At this point, we are using ROUTES, and you can find it at coastalroots.org if you want to look at the project closer.
We'll talk a little bit more about the project later, I'm sure. But before we move on, I guess I'd also have to get your input on, do you say data or data?
Oh, good question. I think I usually say data. Normally when we talk about it, we're talking about people, and I have a hard time calling people data, and the content they give us is usually their interviews or their perspectives. But in the end, yeah, I think I'm a data. I fall on the data side of the debate.
That's where I fall too.
I confess I'm also a big Star Trek fan, and data was the pronunciation on Next Generation. So I'm influenced in that way.
Well, we are recording this in advance by a week or so. So if I remember, I'll try to throw out a poll on Facebook and Twitter to see just how the audience pronounces roots and routes or data or data. So it might be a little interesting to see how that breaks out between us fisheries folk. So the next up, you are the second guest to have spent some time with the Peace Corps. I guess, what got you interested in going that route, and where are some of the locations you've been able to travel to?
So I've been really lucky to have a pretty geographically diverse career, and that really kind of started in the U.S. Peace Corps. I was born and raised in Alaska and did my bachelor's and my master's there. In my master's, I really got into fisheries topics. I grew up in a commercial fishing family, so it had always been kind of part of my life, but to actually get to study it and study the people who were engaged in it was a really cool experience. And the Peace Corps kind of came as an additional calling of a combination of people that I had grown up with. I'm from Homer, Alaska, and there it's a really vibrant community of people who are kind of middle-age and up, who have done lots of traveling in their lives, and a kind of an inordinate number of Peace Corps volunteers for the size of the community. And people were very encouraging when I mentioned I was interested. And then when the Peace Corps, they offer you a particular position in a particular country. Back when I was applying, you did not really have any say over what country you could go to. I think now they give you a little bit more input. But they offered me a kind of rural, very small scale tilapia aquaculture program called the Rural Aquaculture Program in Zambia. And I just thought, wow, you know, what are the odds that I get offered a fishing job in the Peace Corps? So I couldn't help but take it. I definitely wanted to try that. And I went actually from Zambia to Norway when I was offered a PhD position there in Norway. So it's been a nice opportunity to kind of bounce from fishing job to fishing job and get to see what people are doing with fish to either supplement their income or as part of their cultural identity, or as, you know, in the case of Norway, part of a nationwide industry that's booming, to get to see fish in all of those different contexts and how people engage with that animal.
So you just mentioned that you earned your PhD in Norway, and I guess of all the places that have universities and fisheries programs, I guess what drew you to that university or country?
Well, if I'm very honest, the original draw was because they pay you. So Norway has a very, very generous PhD system where you earn a regular salary and there's no tuition costs. So it's essentially like having a job. I also was attracted to the idea of a three-year PhD, which is reasonably common in parts of Europe. And I also, this particular project was called IMPRESS, and it was funded through the EU's Marie Curie Action Scholars Program. And this is a European-wide program that sponsors high-quality PhD education. And this particular program, IMPRESS, IMPRESS is kind of an unusual acronym, but it stands for Improved Production Strategies for Endangered Fish Species. And they focused on sturgeon, salmon, and eel within Europe. And of course, you know, being a salmon person in my background, that was very much an interest to me. But these programs focus a lot on student mobility. So it was a really cool opportunity to get to visit many different parts of Europe and work at different research institutes. For me personally, I got to work at an institute in Berlin that does freshwater fisheries and ecology with Dr. Robert Arlinghaus. And then in Norway, I got to do research with Dr. Øystein Aas at the Norwegian Institute for Nature Research. And throughout that, I get to plan my own PhD in field work. So my particular interest was looking at these voluntarily operated salmon hatcheries that have a long tradition in Western Europe. And that meant getting to work in Norway, getting to design a project and work in Wales, and also get to work with our partners within the PhD there in Germany. And I, you know, that's just such an awesome opportunity to get to have all of those pieces combined, the support, the travel, the different, getting to pursue a species I'm interested in many different contexts. So it, you know, once that opportunity came up, I really couldn't resist. And lucky for me, Norway is a great place to live. Very expensive, but very nice, because I had never been before. So it was kind of showing up with our bag in hand, saying, all right, where's my desk?
All right. Before we dive into your research more specifically, I guess let's go over your research interests a little bit. I guess, what is qualitative social science and humans dimensions research? And I guess, why is it of importance to fisheries and the people that study and utilize them?
Those are really great questions. So I think one struggle I actually had in the PhD was trying to help people who are really raised up through the natural sciences and who are used to kind of data-driven, quantitative ways of doing science, to try and demonstrate the value of a qualitative approach, and particularly within social science. So qualitative work is just that. It's focused on the quality of the content that you're looking at, rather than trying to assign some metric or some value to everything you do. So we don't, within qualitative work, we are still examining data and performing analysis, but instead of using like a survey or counting something, we're asking people their opinions. We're doing a lot of interviews, and some people do photo elicitation. We are trying to understand the why behind the what or the how. And that's really looking at kind of a deeper, perhaps richer way of understanding, particularly people. You know, it's difficult to do qualitative work on something like a wolf, because you can't really ask the wolf anything, so to speak, or on a salmon itself, perhaps. But you can certainly work with the people around them and get a lot more from them than just, you know, how many fish do you catch over how many days. And that's a cool thing, because you can really easily combine that with quantitative data sets and get a much richer and in-depth picture of a fishery, for instance, or a conflict between different fishing groups, which is my particular specialty. So I think within fisheries, there's a huge, huge need for qualitative work, particularly matched up with quantitative exploration of a topic, because you can just get such a better idea of not only what the problem is, but maybe ways that would be acceptable to a stakeholder group in terms of how to address that problem.
Your work in that field focused on these voluntary salmon hatcheries that you mentioned a little bit ago. They might be called something a little bit different here in the U.S. I guess, what is a voluntary hatchery and why might they be controversial?
That's a great question. So hatcheries come in a variety of styles, I think, as probably most of your listeners would know. Sometimes we use them to replace habitat that's been lost. So if a hydropower facility goes in, you're doing replacement stocking through that hatchery. Sometimes the fish are locally extinct from a river or a watershed altogether. And so you're doing a replacement stocking. You're trying to bring back a population that was once there and no longer is. Voluntary stocking kind of falls in a funny middle ground for those things. So some people consider it, particularly on the management side, enhancement stocking, where you have a wild population and you're trying to improve upon it. Maybe it used to be much better in the past. It's now declined for whatever reason, typically an anthropogenic reason. And now you're trying to bring that back to where it was, possibly so it can be exploited for recreational purposes, usually never for commercial purposes in these particular cases that I'm talking about, but for angling. And then maybe it's because you also feel a particular drive to perform conservation. You see the salmon stock that has been there for a long time declining, and you want to do something about it. And a hatchery seems like a great way to do that. So that's been the thinking for a long time. I think many people understand that this used to be a really popular management initiative. And now, somewhere in the last 30 or plus 30 so years, we've begun to realize that, man, you know, maybe hatcheries actually have a pretty negative effect on these wild populations. And what we think is a useful way and a fun way to do conservation is actually expensive and damaging. So there's been the shift in management and shift in policy as a reflection of that. But in Norway and in Wales, there have been groups that have done this for over 100 years in some cases. They are, you know, usually very dedicated, small-scale groups, maybe a river owners association, an angling association, and they just have a really deep love for doing this work. They want to help the salmon. They view it as part of their responsibility as an angler. They view it as their responsibility as, a coastal Norwegian or somebody who lives on the River Wye, for instance, in Wales. They see that as something that they're kind of duty-bound to do. They care. They want to fish. They want to have that relationship with the salmon, if you kind of look at it from a human-environmental relationships kind of perspective. So that it's a very much a voluntary work. It's not mandated by the state at all. And sometimes they may get some funding from the state, but by and large, these are often largely or at least partially self-funded activities. And in the cases I was looking at, there have been some restrictions, and in the case of the Y, a closures altogether of this kind of stocking of salmon for this reason. And that's caused a tremendous amount of controversy from people who really believe that this is good work that they're doing, that they think it's useful. And in particular, it's not that they don't understand the arguments against stocking. Often they're surprisingly experts on all of those things. They've really taken the time to understand the science, the issues with genetics and behavior and physiology, competition, wild stocks, but they are frustrated because they feel, well, no one is really doing anything else. So if we're not going to fix commercial aquaculture problems, if we're not going to fix environmental problems and do meaningful habitat restoration, and of course, in some places they are, but not everywhere, it's very expensive and arduous, legally speaking, they're saying, well, then we should do something. And maybe that something should be this. I had I think he was 92 or 93, as this wonderful Norwegian fisherman. And he was saying to me, you know, God put the salmon here on earth and God's a busy guy. So wouldn't it be nice if we could help him out a little bit by doing some of this work for him? And we actually originally named a paper after that, and it was called God's Little Helpers, but the journal we submitted to did not like that name. So we ended up calling it Nature's Little Helpers. And you can find that on ResearchGate if you're interested to kind of read more about those perspectives on why people really love these hatcheries.
I guess, how were both these voluntary hatcheries and your social science and human dimensions work, how is that all tied together for your PhD work? How did you incorporate those two things together?
So that's a great question. It's funny how that ends up being sometimes the most challenging part of the PhD. In Scandinavia, the model for PhDs like this is to have an article-based thesis. So you write three or four first-authored papers, and of course, trying to get them all published. And then you have to write what's called the kappa, like this piece that ties all of those topics that you wrote about in those articles together. And that was actually one of the most challenging pieces for me, because I'm looking at, you know, we talk about in my thesis, knowledge, local ecological knowledge, and we talk about conflict and using a discourse analysis. We talk about the ideas and conceptualizations of the naturalness, of what nature is and how humans fit into nature when it comes to salmon and the salmon context, and how to link all of those things together is really challenging. And I think in this particular piece of work, it's nice because we have a lot of information about hatcheries in terms of whether or not we think they work, which is, you know, of course, a broad topic unto itself, but do they produce fish? Do those fish survive to come back? Are the fish that do survive to come back as good as the wild ones that existed? We know a lot about that as a scientific community, but we don't really know that much about the people who do this work. And we don't really know that much about why, when we make these managerial decisions to move away from hatcheries, that we face such backlash. And the one of the big impetuses for this project was talking to managers who felt frustrated by that, who said, you know, we're just trying to do the best with the best science we have, but we have to fight this battle. And we're really just not sure why or what to do about that, other than, you know, what people yell at us at a meeting, for instance. So that's really what this research, where that it fits into a gap that existed within this field, is taking the human aspects of that, giving them a face, giving them a voice, helping people understand what's going on in a hatchery besides the production of fish.
It sounds all very interesting and very important, very important part of the fisheries research and management component.
Yeah, I think that most fisheries researchers totally appreciate that there's a big need for human dimensions research, especially in an applied context. It's tough to manage fish because really what you're managing are people who want to have some relationship or engagement with fish. So I really appreciate seeing these sorts of PhD projects and now this postdoc, where there has been a dedication of time and energy and financial resources to support that kind of human dimensions research.
And your PhD work, you mentioned some of the locations, but it took you all over Europe studying some of these fisheries locations. I guess, did you get a chance to fish yourself in some of these locations and catch some different fish throughout the European continent?
I will admit to having grown up in a commercial fishing family in Cook Inlet, Alaska, that admitting to being a sport fisherman or having an interest in recreational angling is sometimes a difficult thing to say in the communities that I'm from. But I have since really become quite fond of angling. I will say I am terrible, just awful. I have not nearly enough practice to call myself a real angler, but it's really enjoyable. And one great thing about qualitative work is in this case, we took an ethnographic approach, and that's kind of a whole field unto itself. But the main aspects of ethnography are that you are really trying to understand an experience or a topic from the point of view of the person that you're studying. And that often means using a method called participant observation, where you spend time in the field doing the things that person is doing with them and trying to have that experience for yourself. And in this case, it often means getting to go fishing and kind of stand on a rainy riverbank, fish with people, listen to their stories, understand exactly the type of gear they use and the methods they use to catch their fish or to have that interaction with the fish. So I do get an opportunity sometimes, but usually it's having somebody kind of help me sort out wherever I've just lodged my hook.
I think that might have drawn a few more prospective students to that side of fisheries research. So.
Yeah, I always tell people that it's one thing to go fishing for to do sampling or something. It's a whole other thing when all of your interviews take place by the river, and then you retire to the local pub afterward to make sure you got all that their perspectives down correctly. Sometimes it's hard to imagine that it's actually my job. It's such a pleasure. You get to meet such interesting people, hear just the best stories. People are so willing to talk about fishing. I think that's such a cool part of this field, is fishing draws out this particular personality who just wants to share their love of either the sport or the lifestyle or the industry with anyone who's willing to listen. And often they have quite a lot to say. So you just kind of get to sit back and listen to this this really cool life from that somebody else is having and share that love of the fish with them.
I guess it sounds like you really enjoyed your project over there, studying in Norway and throughout Europe, the different fisheries. Do you think it was more beneficial to you or than staying in the U.S. and studying some of our North American problems or issues?
That's a good question. You know, obviously, I haven't done a PhD in North America, so I can't really compare. One thing I think I really enjoyed about the European perspective is they have a very different system of fisheries management and fisheries ownership. The way their water bodies are owned and managed is quite different. So getting to see just a really different system of governance was very valuable for my education. I also just really enjoyed the emphasis on mobility and support of PhD education that seems to be pretty par for the course in many of the countries that I worked in. People really value PhDs and see them as an integral part of the staff at a university. And there's a lot of funding. Just from a practical point of view, Europe has a lot of funding mechanisms for PhDs and for their mobility around the continent and elsewhere. And that is, I think, something that's not always as available at that stage in your career within the U.S. Again, I can't, really compare it based on my own experience, but I found this podcast on Twitter and connected through that social media. And I feel like a lot of what I see in North American PhD students talking about, or PhD candidates talking about, the struggles that they're going through. They're just not paid very much, and then they pay tuition, or then they have to kind of work on the side or whatever. And I was really lucky in Norway. That's just not required, because you have all of the resources in place for you to support you during that PhD education. Not to say it isn't still challenging. Obviously, it's still a PhD, but it's nice to have a lot of those pieces that aren't really a part of the education, but certainly affect the education, taken care of and provided. So that support system is really great. I am really pleased to be back in North America now, working in Canada at the University of Guelph. I'm really interested in Great Lakes commercial fisheries and the human dimensions there. It's a surprisingly understudied part of Great Lakes fisheries science. I'm also really interested in the hatcheries that we have here. Canada also has kind of a voluntary hatchery system, a very different context, but a lot of the same effort behind it. There's some similar systems in Maine and on the eastern coast of Canada. So I'm very interested to pursue some of those same topics, but see kind of different worldviews, different ideas about how resources should be managed. One additional piece I'll add to that is that in North America, we are used to having a lot of everything. Alaskan fisheries are measured by the millions for salmon. In Europe, people are talking about a couple of hundred fish in a river, and they're really excited for that. So just seeing the scale and how delicate an ecosystem can be, that when you're talking about a run that needs conservation, you're talking about a really small number of individuals in that run sometimes. Not always, obviously, but more often than not, certainly in comparison to the context that I grew up with in the salmon world. So that's, I think, a really neat way to have experienced my PhD, is to have this just wildly different context and in some cases worldviews on conservation. There's a much longer horizon that people are looking at when they're talking about fisheries conservation, modern fisheries conservation in Europe, whereas here in North America, once you kind of leave indigenous ways of managing and caring for species, you're looking at a relatively short history of European fisheries management here. So it's an interesting dichotomy to look across and compare your experience across.
Another interesting dichotomy between North America and Europe is their passion for carp fishing. Did you get into any of that when you were over there? You worked mostly with salmon, but they're kind of carp crazy over there.
No, sadly, I have such a passion for salmon that I've gotten into very few other species. I think sturgeon and eel I've had now the most exposure with, and even that has been kind of through the kindness of my fellow PhD cohort and candidates there, who were nice enough to talk about their research with me. I am sadly not a carp fisherman.
All right. Well, now you're back over in North America, and you mentioned you're at the University of Guelph completing a postdoctoral position. I guess tell us a little bit more about some of the work you're doing there and what you'll be looking into. You mentioned Great Lakes work.
Sure. Yeah. So the University of Guelph here in Guelph, Ontario, and it's a really great opportunity. I feel quite fortunate to have been able to find a position that fits me so well. I think, as many people know, there's a lot of PhDs who are coming out with their degree and not nearly enough postdoc positions. So I feel really fortunate to have found one that's a good fit for my interests and in a location that I'm really excited to be living. I've really just stepped into this position recently. I'm working with Dr. Philip Loring and at the Errol Food Institute and at the Department of Geography here at the University of Guelph. And we have a relationship of working together back in Alaska, and it was just a really neat opportunity to get to come here and have a lot of control over the types of projects that I'm interested in. I've just stepped into the position about a month ago, so I'm still kind of developing the framework of what I want to work on. But I have three primary interests. One is continuing this hatchery work. I think it would be really neat to kind of take a broad international perspective on salmon hatcheries, this local effort rather than these big state-run operations, and write about that. I think hatcheries are a challenge that Europe is facing and has kind of made some big steps on recently in the last few decades. I think North America is going to see something similar. And you know, back in my home state of Alaska, hatcheries are a huge part of the fisheries landscape. But I think a day is going to come where we're going to rethink that approach. So I'm interested to kind of keep an ear to the ground on those issues and try and do some writing that's interesting not only to the scientific community, but also to the angling community, to the kind of the popular science community, if you will. I'm also really interested in these Great Lakes commercial fisheries that I mentioned to you. The Great Lakes are just such a fascinating set of cases. They have had some very rich commercial fisheries in the past. They've had huge ups and downs with invasive species, with crashes of their fish stocks. And what's really interesting to me, just kind of from a first glance, is that these commercial fisheries have persisted through these huge changes. And that is not something that can be said for commercial fisheries elsewhere in the world who have faced similar kinds of challenges. So I'm quite interested to do some more qualitative work to really engage the commercial fishers themselves in discussions about what they do and how it is that they've been able to persist through so many regime changes over time. Particularly since there are now far fewer commercial fishers on the Great Lakes than there once were. And I'd be interested to see more about that and bring kind of a qualitative and human dimensions perspective to the literature on that. And finally, this Coastal Roots Project. And this is, I'm hoping that I can ask your listeners for a little help on this. So this is a new project, and we are interested in coastal communities on Canada's three coasts, and maybe arguably four coasts, if you would include the Great Lakes. And we are wanting to hear stories that have to do with food security, that have to do with fisheries, maybe even agriculture, from coastal communities that have faced some sort of challenge and have successfully overcome it in some way. So we've talked about this as kind of bright spots in people or in communities where they have been able to be resilient against something that's happened in their community. So maybe this was an effect of climate change. They've had some really serious weather. They've had destruction of perhaps seawalls, or maybe they've had a collapse in fisheries, a shift in the local economy, something that's happened. And then now they have an interesting story where they can talk about what works, the things that they have done to successfully overcome that. We'll be starting a podcast, and it will be tied to another podcast called Rural Roots, which is out of Memorial University. And we'll be kind of pairing with them a little bit and producing a series of episodes where we talk about these case studies and explore some of these things, like what is it that's working? What is it that isn't working? How can we take those success stories and help distill some of the key points and messages and lessons learned and then apply them elsewhere? So if you would allow me to do so, I would encourage your listeners, if they can think of a great case that's like that, they think that their community has something awesome to offer, that would be a great story that we would love to talk to them about that. And they can find us at coastalroots.org. Coastal, R-O-U-T-E-S.org, and contact us that way. Both myself and the information for Phil Loring, the project director for this project, are there on the front page. And we would love to hear those stories. We really want to hear what people have to say about what's working, what they're doing successfully.
And does this project have social media accounts that people could also get in contact with?
So far you could tweet at us if you want to. Phil is at Conserve Change, and I'm at AK_ FISCIENCE, fish science, kind of all squished together as one word. And we would love to hear from people. It's a really great way. We share your case studies, share your research, share whatever it is you caught the other day and you thought would make a great example of changes that have happened in your community and that you see people successfully overcoming them.
Well, Hannah, thank you for filling us all in on your work overseas and now back here in North America. But the tough part of the interview is now over, as we are down to the final five questions. And this is a group of five questions I ask each of the guests that come on the show. And we always start real simple with, what is your favorite fish?
Oh, hands down, the Pacific salmon. In particular, I'm a coho person. Although if you press me for it to eat, a white king.
What is your favorite memory from your career so far?
Oh, wow. There are a number. Give me just a second. Let me think of, I've been trying to think of a story that's appropriate. So I have a lot of really nice memories from the field work I've done. I definitely, some of the best things have been from the field work, getting to spend time with fishermen in the field. But one thing that I really love about fishing communities is they tend to be made up of families. So people really, that experience they have with bringing their own children into the fishery that they love is really, really cool. And I have this nice memory of being in a Norwegian hatchery, this one of these small scale voluntary hatcheries, and seeing a guy, he's probably in his 40s, and he was an avid volunteer for the hatchery. He'd come in to do an interview with us and to just do his regular hatchery chores. And he brought along his daughter, and she, I think she was maybe 7 or 8. And it was just so cool to see them work as a team, that she loved the fish. She'd look into the tank and say hello to them. She kind of treated them like they were her personal pets in a way. And just watching her sprinkle a little feed in the tank and scoop a little of, you know, the debris from the surface of the water, and then just watch them stand there together and point into the tank and talk about the fish, and just the smile on their faces. You know, that was a really cool experience to see that and really get to feel the love that people have for fish in whatever way that they're getting to engage with them. So I would say that's one of maybe the more appropriate stories. I do feel like a lot of research seems to take place in a bar sometimes. And maybe those aren't so great for the podcast, so I'll skip those.
And you've worked all over countries A to Z, Alaska to Zambia. I guess, what is your dream job or dream location to work in?
I kind of have my dream job at the moment. I hope I get to do this sort of thing forever, that this is just very much what I love to do, to talk to fishermen, to visit places with fish, touch those fish, experience a fishery. That I really couldn't ask for more. I'm really lucky in that regard. I really hope to get back to Alaska someday. It's a really unique, wonderful place to work. I think right now it's having some political challenges and some economic crises. So it's not ideal to be heading that back there with my career right now, but that's very much where I will always consider home. And I really hope to get back there, either visiting with field work through projects like Coastal Roots, or maybe being able to find my own funding and spawning a project there myself. It would be, I think, a really nice place to have, for example, a human ecology field school, or some other way to bring people from around the world to really appreciate the intricate, rich nature of Alaskan resources and fisheries.
And you mentioned you were just starting your postdoctoral work and trying to develop these projects. So you might have had an idea, but if money is not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
If money were not an object, oh gosh. If money were not an object, I think I would plant myself right square in the middle of Alaskan Cook Inlet fisheries and would want to work on a human dimensions project there to somehow come up with an equitable way to share the fisheries there so that we can move past a lot of these user group conflicts that have plagued Alaskan fisheries for years and years.
And the final question, if there is one point or one principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
That's a great question. And I think I would kind of harken back to something I touched on a little earlier in our discussion, that ultimately fisheries management and fisheries research is about the people who care about fish. And I, you know, this is maybe a not so popular opinion, or maybe a bit of a controversial opinion, But I think that relationship means that we as fisheries scientists and researchers have an obligation. We have a responsibility to do our very, very best to communicate our work and the value of our work to the public. And I know that, you know, sometimes people feel that that's really beyond the purview of scientists, it's not our job to tell people what we do. We write about it, we publish it, we go back to doing the work. And I would respectfully disagree. I think that it's really essential that we become better science communicators, that we become good at talking to people and talking to stakeholders and taxpayers, the people who fund our work, and explaining what we do, why they should give a damn, why they should care. And I think that's a skill set just like any other that has to be developed. You can be great at stats. You can be great at interviews, data analysis. You should also spend the time to be better at science communication, to bother with science communication. So hopefully that doesn't get me too many nasty comments on Twitter, but I really view that as the next important task of the scientific community. And I'm really pleased to see that kind of training is already showing up in PhD programs and master's programs. It's becoming an important, quote unquote, soft skill, even though I would argue it's not even so soft. It really should be a part of any scientist training. So yeah, that would be my choice.
Well, Hannah, thank you again for volunteering to come on the podcast today and helping me get out of a pinch. It was a pleasure hearing about you and your projects involving human dimensions, and both in North America and in Europe. If people want to find out more information or get a hold of you, what would be the best way to do that?
If people want to get a hold of me, they can find me on Facebook, Hannah L. Harrison. They can also find me on Twitter. And again, that handle is CAPK_FISCIENCE. And they can also find me through the Coastal Roots website, and that's coastalroots.org. And I'd love to hear from people. So by all means, please look me up. And I appreciate your audience taking some time to hear about the social sciences and qualitative approaches to fisheries research. And thanks very much to you for having me. This has been really great.
No problem. Thank you again for helping me fill this vacancy right before I leave on vacation.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And if anyone would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter at FisheriesPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. Or old-fashioned email, feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. And if any listeners out there are interested in being a guest on the show, just reach out to me and we can get you on. I'm always looking for good stories to tell, and volunteers make that job a heck of a lot easier. So I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download and subscribe to receive future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 36th episode of The Fisheries Podcast. And remember, fisheries managers and researchers need to be better about communicating the value of their work to those who utilize and care about the fish.